Today on The Whistleblowers, America's prison system is in a state of disarray. President Donald Trump knows that and, to his credit, has tried to do something about it. Indeed, about a year ago, he even named a former federal prisoner as the new deputy director of the Federal Bureau of Prisons. That was a bold move, but a year later, almost nothing has changed. I'm John Kiriakou, and this is The Whistleblowers. Violence is still rampant in the American prison system. Suicides among prisoners are up. Heck, suicides among guards are up. And the problem of prison contraband is still rampant. When I was serving nearly 2 years in prison for blowing the whistle on the CIA's torture program, drugs were everywhere. And the conventional wisdom was that it was the guards who were bringing it in. Over just the past 3 months, dozens of federal prison guards around the country have been arrested and prosecuted for bringing everything from cell phones to hard drugs to barbecued chicken wings into prison for secret sale to prisoners. This isn't something new. It's been going on for decades, but it's not getting any better. Just as a few examples, earlier this month, prosecutors in the state of Maryland announced that they had charged three prison guards with smuggling MDMA pills, fentanyl, marijuana, and methamphetamine into the Jessup Correctional Institution. They now face decades in prison. In Kentucky last month, prison guard Billy Williams was arrested and charged with first-degree promoting contraband for bringing thousands of dollars worth of contraband, including methamphetamine, into the prison in exchange for bribes from prisoners' families. And Travis County, Texas prison guard Amos Nyanwe was arrested in October and charged with smuggling. It wasn't drugs that he was sneaking into the prison, however. It was barbecued chicken wings. Chicken is immensely popular in prison. I don't know why. The chickens that we were fed were so scrawny that they probably couldn't have even produced a broth. But Nyanwe apparently had a good side business going, selling thousands of dollars worth of chicken wings to prisoners. If the government knows what the problem is, why don't authorities do something about it? Well, we're joined by Paul Wright. He's the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center, the country's leading prisoners' rights organization. And he's the publisher and editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. Paul, welcome to the show. Glad to have you back.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show, John.
Paul, first, I want to say that not all drugs and not all contraband are brought into prisons by prison guards, but most of it is. Why hasn't the government...
The vast majority of it is.
It is. And why is that? Why hasn't the government been able to stop it?
Well, if you think about it, just from a logistics viewpoint, the guards can bring in pretty much larger quantities in their lunch boxes, in their pockets, taped to their bodies, and stuff like that. And the reality is that prisons are really American institutions of total surveillance. Prisoners have very little privacy. Anyone that thinks that visitors are bringing drugs in, and sure, I'm sure some minuscule quantities get in through visiting rooms, but, you know, visitors don't have a big opportunity to bring drugs in the first place. They're searched, they're under constant surveillance. The prisoners, if they are contact visits, and a lot of visits in prisons are non-contact, they're through glass or dividers, so there is no actual physical contact. There just isn't a lot of opportunity to do that. We've heard, various... fabrications over the years is that there's supposedly large quantities of drugs coming in through the mail. And then we see that in states like Missouri, they ban all physical mail and drug seizures and drug overdoses go up. So I think first off, it's just that. And I think the reality is that the American police state, it's always had a corruption problem. Mm-hmm. And they just can't acknowledge that their staff are corrupt. And the bottom line is they can't control their staff. And I think two things show this. One, there's not a maximum security prison in America where the prisoners cannot get any illegal drug they want to. Heroin, cocaine, fentanyl, ecstasy, you name it, you can get it. Much higher prices, but you can get it. And these are places where there is no way for prisoners to get things from any place except inside the prison. And I guess a quick anecdote on this, I think about the fact that of how little concern prison officials have. I was working in the prison law library at the Washington State Reformatory in the 1990s, and a guy comes in And he's asking for help. He's saying, you know, wow, I just got a dirty UA. I just lost 30 days of good time. And I just got done doing 30 days in segregation. What can I do about it? And I'm telling him, well, you know, 30 UA, there's not really a lot you can really do to challenge that. And I said, you know, and you do know, of course, that anyways, he goes on to start complaining about, you know, why they have these crackdowns on drug users and everything else. And I told him, you do realize that no one really cares about the fact that you're using drugs or whatever. And he's, what do you mean? And he says, this is like my fifth or sixth infraction. I've lost months of good time. I've spent all these months in segregation. And I said, okay, and at any point through all these drug infractions, has anyone from the prison administration ever asked you where you got these drugs from? And he's like, no. And I'm like, okay, do you think that if they cared about drug use in prison, they would at least ask you where you got them from? Whether or not you tell them is another thing, but at least they could ask, even if you told them, I'm not telling you. Mm-hmm. And I think that's also one of the things that I think is kind of emblematic about this. When you start looking at like prison disciplinary reports around the country, every prison system, it's like thousands and thousands and thousands of prisoners are being infracted for drug use and possession. And no one ever asked them, where'd you get the drugs from? And I think that's kind of, in my mind, tells me all I need to know about where this is in the list of priorities.
Well, and that points to a bigger problem, it seems, and that's the problem of overall prison conditions. Nobody in a position of authority, whether it's in the Department of Justice or on Capitol Hill, nobody really cares about prison conditions. Many of the guards are crooked. They're too stupid to do anything. Is that why we don't see improvements? Because overall, there's just nobody who cares?
So I've been doing prisoner rights advocacy for going on 40 years now, since 1987, 1988, when I first went to prison. And I can just say this, you know, when's the last time anyone in a government job lost their job because someone in prison died needlessly, got raped needlessly, or otherwise was poorly treated? Mm-hmm. About the only times that you ever see anyone lose their job in the prison bureaucracy is if a prisoner escapes. Right. That's about it.
Right.
You're not really seeing anyone, you know, there's very little consequences. And the reality, especially at the federal level, is, you know, there really is no oversight of the prison system. I mean, nominally, over the years, I've watched all these congressional hearings, and I think they're very performative, but, you know, nothing ever comes of them. You know, one of the most embarrassing ones, I think Mr. Samuels was the BOP director, and then Senator Franken from Minnesota asked him, what's the average size of a cell in the federal prison system?
I remember it well. Yes.
Yeah, and he said, I don't know.
He didn't know.
And
he was a prison guard, and he didn't know.
Yes, he was a prison guard, and he didn't know. And I think that's one of those things, too. At the start of the show, you mentioned the fact that President Trump has appointed Josh Smith as the deputy director of the BOP. And I think on the one hand, this is really good. You know, I think it's good that we have formerly incarcerated people, in positions involved in the criminal justice system. The flip side of it, though, is he is an informant who ratted out his co-defendants to lessen his own sentence, and he has a lot of ties with the private prison industry.
Yes, indeed.
So I'm kind of thinking that, you know, I'm not sure that this is kind of the ex-prisoner that we necessarily want in a position, because there's been nothing to really show that he's ever been involved or cares about reform. And, you know, and like I said, I'm happy to give him the benefit of the doubt. And, you know, hopefully for the best. But as you noted, a year into the Trump administration, nothing is getting better. If anything, it's as bad, if not worse, than it was before. But I also think, too, is the reality is, you know, these are big systems. And I think the analogy is, it's not easy to turn an aircraft carrier around in mid voyage. And the reality is the BOP in particular is in very bad shape, but it's taken decades of mismanagement, neglect, and outright, malfeasance to get to where it's at. You know, it didn't get there overnight, and I think fixing it isn't going to be overnight. But I think like a lot of things, though, when you look at just the overall system of the Bureau of Prisons, to use that as an example, they've got a lot of structural problems, and I don't think there's anything. Last time I looked at their website, over half of their management positions were vacant. So, which kind of begs the question of who's actually running the show.
And Paul, this is not, to be clear, this is not just a problem at the federal level. Federal prisons.
Absolutely not.
Federal prisons are probably in better shape than prisons at the state and local levels. We hear these nightmare stories about state prisons, especially in the southern part of the United States, where people are kept in solitary confinement in oftentimes subhuman conditions for decades on end.
It's beyond that. We could do entire shows about the implosion at every level of prison systems in Georgia, Alabama, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Florida. I mean, you know, the death rates are horrific. You know, it's beyond third world. And
why is that happening?
Well, I think what we're alluding to at the beginning, well, we're not alluding to, I mean, we're saying it, is the fact of, you know, no one in government, state or federal cares. And it's not even a thing. I mean, the thing that really gets me, though, is that this isn't about spending money. On the one hand, they say, well, you know, we don't want to spend money on our prisons. And so you can say maybe they're underfunded. But the reality is, objectively, even the poorest states in the United States are spending huge amounts of money on their prison systems compared to, you know, almost any other country in the world. But I also think this is one of the differences, though. And I know you've been to prisons in other countries, haven't you, John?
Yes. In fact, I took a tour of several prisons in Afghanistan, and I had been in prisons in Yemen and Pakistan as well.
Okay. And I think the difference is when you go, when you talk to the people running these places, you talk to the wardens. And, you know, they'll tell you, you know, we're a poor country. We don't have a lot of resources. Prisons aren't at the top of the resource list in terms of government agencies getting funded. But you know what? We're doing the best we can with what we got.
Right.
And I think the difference is you come to the United States, you know, prison agencies have billion-dollar budgets. California alone, I think it's, what, $13 billion?
Right.
The BOP is $7 billion. And then you look at the results that they're getting, and it's like nowhere near the bang for the buck that they should be getting. And I think that's kind of, you know, where the disconnect is. But it's also a thing, too, where the United States spends a lot of money. And I think the United States is unique among countries in the world today where a lot of prison officials and a lot of government officials are literally doing everything they can to make things worse. You know, so it's not an idea of like, hey, people are coming into prison. They've got issues. They've got problems. What can we do to make them better so when they get out of prison, they can become productive members of society and at least not commit crimes or not return to prison? And, you know, and that is not part of the equation. That has not been a part of the official purpose of prisons in the United States for many, many decades now. And it shows at every level.
Paul, tell us a little bit about the current state of medical care in prisons. It was my experience that prisons attract the worst doctors. Medication is routinely denied to prisoners. And many, many deaths in prison could have been easily prevented. What's your experience?
That's exactly it. I mean, I would say we publish prison legal news, and I would say probably for decades now, at least half of our coverage is around inadequate medical care. And I think one of the comments I heard early on when I got to prison back in the 80s was prison will make a young man old and an old man dead.
Yes.
And I think this is one of those things that what we see time after time after time is people dying from basically medical neglect for very, very simple, ailments. You know, whether it's diabetes, hypertension, cancer, you know, things that outside of prison would be quickly and easily treatable. Mm-hmm. One of the worst trends that we've got going on in the United States is the massive privatization of prison medical care with for-profit companies like Centurion, Wexford, NAFCare. These are, you know, the Horizon. These are kind of like the bigger ones. And their entire business model is premised upon getting as much money out of the government for medical care and then providing as little medical care as possible to the prisoner population.
That's right.
And we've done public records requests where we've seen just like, you know, the money that these companies spend on litigation resulting from denied medical care. And you know, it's clear that their business model is we deny the medical care, we will make our money on that. If we get sued, we'll pay out a little bit of money, but we're still coming out ahead financially by denying the medical care in the first place.
Paul, stay right there. We need to take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to speak more with Paul on the lack of prison reform in the United States. Stay tuned. This is The Whistleblowers. Welcome back. We're talking about the lack of prison reform in the United States with our guest, Paul Wright. He's the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center, the country's leading prisoners' rights organization. And he's also the publisher and editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. Paul, thanks again for being with us. Happy to have you.
Thanks for having me on the show, John.
Paul, the Federal Correctional Institution in Dublin, California, a women's prison, was recently closed because 14 officials there, including the warden, the chaplain, and the doctor, were convicted of raping prisoners. And indeed, the prison became known as the Rape Club. The government has had to pay out millions of dollars to the women who were raped. How common
is
sexual...
Over $100
million. I think I looked it up as $114 million. Yes. How common is sexual assault in prison? And I mean guards and officials assaulting prisoners. And how is this allowed to happen?
It's extremely common. And one of the things that I think that one of the things that after doing this work for going on almost four decades, not to date myself too badly, you know, you kind of see like these ongoing patterns. And this is only the latest one. It's, and I would say almost every prison system around the country, every 5 years, there's a major scandal about guards in the women's prison raping the guards and the staff raping the prisoners. Mm-hmm. And this happens a lot at the jail level, at the local level as well. And I think this goes to the two commonalities that prisons have. They're not transparent. There's no accountability. And I think that that's part of the problem. I mean, the thing that was stunning to me about the prison at Dublin, and this is close to the Bay Area in San Francisco. So, you know, this isn't someplace that's, you know, somewhere out in some rural hinterland, mm-hmm. with, you know, for lack of a better term, you know, lack of adult supervision or anything. I mean, you know, this is a major women's prison close to one of the largest urban areas in the United States, centers of power, media, and everything else. And these rapes just went on for years and years, as they do. And part of the thing that I think is kind of stunning is you mentioned the warden was convicted of raping. He wasn't just convicted of raping. He's like videotaping himself on his government-issued cell phone sexually assaulting the prisoners.
Oh, my God.
And this is kind of the things that even guys like me were, okay, I've been reporting on this stuff for decades. This is a little eyebrow raising. And I think, but this also goes, I think, to the critical role of leadership is when you have people at the very highest levels of the institution taking part in and raping people themselves, how are you expecting the staff below you to do any better than that? And so the thing is, like, and this has also come up with a lot of, one of the BOP officials has been charged with rape. I think he was a lieutenant. Like, his handle is Dirty Dick. And it's kind of like, okay, so your own employees have handles among prisoners and staff like Dirty Dick, and no one thinks there's something wrong here, there's a problem. And I think as you noted, you know, the chaplain was also convicted of raping prisoners. Last time I looked, I want to say that there's at least 30 or 40 more staff that have been indicted and not tried or haven't pleaded out yet. Dozens have already been convicted, and there's still ongoing investigations to more. And I think that one of the things that's really critical to note is the Bureau of Prisons did not close this prison because the guards were raping the prisoners, like it was some Bosnian rape camp in Yugoslavia in the 90s or something. They closed the prison because a federal judge appointed a special master to oversee what was happening at the prison. And that's the first time that's ever happened in federal prison history. Exactly. And rather than be subject to any type of outside supervision, especially by a representative of the federal judiciary, they decided to close the prison. That
just
was their response.
Crazy.
It wasn't to stop the rapes or anything like that. It was to avoid any type of scrutiny or any type of accountability that they closed the prison.
Are you at all hopeful of any positive changes with, as we said at the top of the show, a former federal prisoner now being the new deputy director of the Bureau of Prisons? Should we expect to see positive changes?
So basically, Mr. Marshall was the former director of the West Virginia prison system, and he was appointed to the BOP director. And Mr. Smith, you know, he comes from being an informant and a federal drug trafficker, and running a halfway house and doing some sketchy real estate deals, and he's the deputy director. I would say that as far as the director level with Mr. Marshall, he's gone from, he went from kind of not doing too much to change or fix a poorly run, mismanaged prison system at the state level that was in crisis, to trying to fix one supposedly at the federal level that's much bigger and maybe with bigger problems on a much bigger scale. And his track record, and he comes from a state police background. He doesn't even come from a from a penology background. And I guess one of the things that I always look at is, you're getting people, what's their background in fixing stuff? And I'm not even saying that you need to be an expert in prison operations or penology or anything like that, because I think in the last 40 years or so, in some respects, the worst people are the ones that come from within the system. Those are the worst ones. I think whatever modest improvements we've had in prison systems in the United States, and probably at least the last 30 years, have all been from people that came from outside of a prison system. You know, they weren't necessarily prison experts or whatever. They had experience running systems, they had experience running businesses and things like that. And I think that that was a help. So I would say there's nothing in either one of them, in either one of their pasts or anything like that, that makes me think that we have reason to be optimistic. And I think the bigger thing is, with big organizations, I don't think you really expect, you know, one or two individuals can't do anything. You need to bring in a whole team of people, just like no one expects General Motors or Microsoft or whatever. No one thinks that it's just one person running these a big company. It's the same thing with this. I mean, you think about the Bureau of Prisons, for example, 40,000 employees, 150, 140, 150,000 prisoners. That's almost a quarter million people that you're responsible for. It's a lot of moving parts and things like that. And I'm not really sure that you have people, you know, you come from running the state police, you come from running, you know, doing real estate and drug deals. I'm not really sure this is preparing you for, you know, running large, you know, large organizations. And I think the important thing too is there's a lot of moving parts to it. And some of the things, I to be honest, I think that one of the best things that President Trump did was eliminating the prison guards union at the BOP and also with other law enforcement agencies. And I think that a lot of people on the progressive side of things, and you know, I count myself among them, and I think a lot of people think, oh, unions are good. And I'm always having to tell people, look, maybe unions are great in other contexts, but when it comes to law enforcement, specifically prison guards and police unions, they are not good. They are obstacles to reform. They're obstacles to progress. They're obstacles to accountability. So in some respects, I think that one of the best things that's happened already is eliminating the guards union.
Paul, I couldn't agree more. I'm actually a union member, and I come from a long line of union members, and I wholeheartedly supported
Donald Trump's actions. My father was a member of the Postal Employees Union his entire career at the post office. So, so I'm not anti-union.
No, no, nor am I.
When it comes to prison guards and police, they should not be unionized.
This had to be done. Well, Paul Wright, we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks for joining us. Paul Wright is the executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center, and he's the publisher and editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the show, John.
That's our show for today. Please subscribe to my Substack at John Kiriakou. Stay informed, and as always, keep asking the hard questions. I'm John Kiriakou. Thanks for watching The Whistleblowers.